I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
President Bush and British Prime Minister Tony Blair say there are weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. Tony Blair telling reporters, before people crow about the absence of weapons of mass destruction, I suggest they wait a little bit. Well, the claim of the existence of unconventional weapons was one of the main justifications for war in Iraq. We're asking, do you think it matters now whether such weapons are found?
I think saving the people and their government, setting up ways of having new establishments and institutions to start democracy working is more important than finding the weapons.
Well, yeah, I'd like to see that all after all this fuss that we were justified. It doesn't look likely, but I'd like to see them found.
I think it'll justify the war, but, I mean, if they don't find them, they don't find them. They did what they have to do, and they're definitely getting rid of the regime over there, and I think that's the whole point. So it doesn't really matter to me.
Thoughts on weapons of mass destruction from some people we spoke with today.
We'll have more on the search for WMDs in Iraq in a moment, but first, in Baghdad today, more than 200 Iraqi delegates, Shiites, Sunnis, Kurds, sat down with General Jay Garner, the American administrator overseeing reconstruction efforts in Iraq, hoping to begin the formation of a new unified government. Now, Major General Tim Cross, the deputy civil administrator of Iraq, spoke about the progress made at today's conference.
We're beginning to see a new democracy emerging, so some people are now saying things they would never have been able to say for 35 years. But there are some people who want us to leave very, very quickly, and there are some people who want us to stay for a long, long time. The reality is, I think that we will stay as long as we are needed and leave as soon as the people here are ready for us to leave.
Major General Tim Cross at the Iraqi conference in Baghdad, a day which happens to be the 66th birthday of the man who used to run Iraq, Saddam Hussein. Joining me now on the line from Baghdad is Rod Nordland of Newsweek magazine. Thanks for joining us, Rod.
My pleasure.
Rod, you've just been at that meeting. Any concrete developments there, or still mostly General Garner and the delegates kind of taking the measure of each other?
Well, it's actually still going on, and we expect to have summing up statements soon. But generally, they're trying to downplay expectations from this. They're saying it's just the first of many meetings, which will eventually, hopefully, lead towards some sort of interim administration. Basically, they have a lot of problems. One is, who are they talking to? There are demonstrations in the streets today from groups that don't feel represented, particularly the Shiites. Last night, they arrested the self-proclaimed mayor of Baghdad, this fellow Mohammed Zubaydi. He was lured to a meeting with Garner and then put in handcuffs and led away at gunpoint to kind of take his organization apart on the claim that he was trying to pilfer money from the National Bank, which may or may not be true. But the fact is there are a lot of elements in this city that feel unrepresented at this meeting, and the meeting itself is not likely to produce anything very concrete at this point.
Well, Rod, there was a new attendee at the meeting, was there not? The Supreme Council of the Islamic Revolution in Iraq, an Iranian-based group of Shiite Muslim exiles, which boycotted the last meeting with Garner, did show up. Significant?
Well, it's very significant, and they've been trying very hard to get that to happen. They have, brought in a number of people that weren't there before. There were 350 delegates, maybe, not 200, which is better than they expected. In Nasiriyah, they only managed 70, and they had crowds at the gates of the place demonstrating against the meeting. That hasn't happened here, but then the gates here are about two miles away, and the security that they set up around the meeting made it almost impossible for anybody to express their views about it. But around town today, there was an awful lot of negative sentiment about it, and an awful lot of suspicion about what coalition intentions are. I think most Baghdadis feel that we're here to take the oil, and that we're here to stay, and that we're occupying the country and so on. It's going to be a big job to persuade them otherwise.
Rod Nordland of Newsweek magazine joining us from Baghdad. Thanks so much, Rod.
You're welcome.
The Bush administration is beefing up its weapons inspection team in Iraq, tripling the number of engineers and scientists already on the job. The administration claims that Iraqi officials told American investigators Saddam Hussein may have ordered the destruction of weapons before the war started. And U.S. General Tommy Franks says finding the weapons may require searching thousands of sites. Well, joining us now on the line from Doha, Qatar, is New York Times reporter Eric Schmidt. He's been following this search. Eric, have they found anything yet?
Well, they have, Robin. In fact, just in the last couple of days, they found some very suspicious 55-gallon drums propped up with gravel in an open field near the northern Iraq town of Vaji. Initial tests indicated that one drum might contain the nerve agent cyclosarin, and a blister agent could have been mustard gas. My colleague Judith Miller, who's actually with one of these what they call mobile exploitation teams, these are the specialists that actually are doing the more refined tests, have now determined they don't believe it is either one of those agents. But this is just one of many examples of things that military teams are coming across that the military has to check very carefully because initial sensors are often incorrect.
Right. And General Franks has said that he doesn't want to come across like Baghdad Bob, as you write. And, of course, that's the former information minister of Iraq who became the disinformation minister, as he was called. So how cautious are they being while still trying to insist that there are weapons?
They're walking this fine line because, on the one hand, obviously this is one of the main reasons the Bush administration made for going to war in Iraq, that the fact that there were, they believed, you know, large quantities of chemical, possibly biological weapons that were a threat to the regional security and possibly the United States. But now that the war is essentially over and the United States and the coalition have access to most of the country now, they have yet to turn anything up. It's become somewhat of an embarrassment for the administration. So as you said, they're cranking up the number of specialists here on the ground. They're trying to get more testers in. But they really only believe they're going to find any of this when they can hook up with the Iraqis who either worked on the programs or who have hidden it.
Well, what about the captured Iraqis in the last few days who've said that so much of the chemical and biological weapons were destroyed?
Well, they're weighing that as well. I mean, it's on the one hand, you had some inspectors here with the United Nations who were here for some weeks and months before the war actually started. So the question is, well, how would they have destroyed a lot of this stuff? There are some reports that they may have smuggled some of this out of the country, perhaps to Syria. And yet there was so much of particularly some of the chemical weapons, it's just hard to believe, if the intelligence was correct in the first place, that they were able to destroy or spirit this stuff out of the country. Many military officials here believe that this stuff is just buried all over the place. It's just going to take a long time to find it.
Have you heard any U.S. officials speaking to the sentiments expressed in Thomas Friedman's column yesterday that it really doesn't matter if they find any weapons of mass destruction? Who cares, I'm quoting, if we now find some buried barrels of poison? Do they carry more moral weight than the buried skulls they're unearthing of the victims of Saddam Hussein's regime?
There's certainly a feeling among some military officials that the American public doesn't really care anymore. The war has essentially been won. They're now billing it as a war of liberation. And the fact that one of the reasons they went in was for weapons of mass destruction is kind of a second thought now. It is, however, a big issue with allies in Europe and around the world and at the United Nations as well. So the credibility of the United States is still very much on the line in that sense.
Mm-hmm. Eric, thank you.
You're welcome.
Eric Schmidt, correspondent for The New York Times, spoke to us from Doha, Qatar.
$1.4 billion. That's how much 10 security firms and two analysts have agreed to pay to settle conflict of interest charges against them. Charges that Wall Street research analysts in the go-go 90s and beyond hyped earnings reports to lure investment banking business. A big deal, but how much will it matter to battered average investors? One question we want to pose now to Gretchen Morgenson of The New York Times. Welcome, Gretchen.
How are you, Bill?
Good, thanks. Gretchen, we're reading that $437 million of this $1.4 billion will be going to the states, but will probably be used to pay off deficits, not investors. Will investors see any return from this settlement?
investors are going to have volumes of evidence that are going to be released today to help them launch their own private lawsuits, Bill. It was felt by the regulators that the unfortunate aspect of some of these broad settlements in the past, where Wall Street is concerned, the impact has been that investors got very little, if anything, out of them, maybe cents on the dollar. And so the view was by the regulators that if we put this information out there and allow them to bring their own cases, then they would be better off.
Uh-huh. Now, what about the bigger picture? Will anything change in the long term, the broad sweep of how business is done on Wall Street?
There is going to be a new separation, a redrawing of the line between investment banking and research that was so blurred in the bubble when analysts were just bankers in disguise. You will have more of a wall that can't be penetrated by the bankers. Bankers will have to sort of lay off research. Research will be left alone more and not urged to be positive in order to make the clients happy. You will also see a growing up of independent research firms on the street, because I think people will be for years suspect of any research that they get out of a Wall Street firm. You'll have a lot more compliance efforts in place also to make sure that analysts are left alone.
So as someone with your kind of ear to the pavement every day on Wall Street, do you sense that this will restore investor confidence, or is it going to take a lot longer to heal that?
I think it's going to take a lot longer to heal, and honestly, because of this aspect of the individuals being able to bring their own suits, it seems like that is going to really be a long process, and so I don't think that it's going to happen overnight, Bill. I think the trust has been just devastated, and it just you can't rebuild it that quickly. Now, I also think that because we are not in the throes of another bull market, we are still in a very, very bad market. There are no new companies bringing their shares public, that you really can't tell how this new structure is going to work. You will only know whether this structure will work to protect the individual investor when we have another bull market.
Henry Blodgett, the former internet analyst at Merrill Lynch, and Jack Grubman, the former telecommunications analyst at Salomon Smith Barney, are the two analysts fingered in this.
Yes.
Tell me, kind of in a New York style, is there a sense of satisfaction in the streets there that these two guys who became so notorious are kind of getting their own back?
Well, I guess you would say that there is some satisfaction that they have to pay something. But, I mean, in the grand scheme of things, $4 million is not a lot. And certainly $15 million for Mr. Grubman is not a lot, since he made $20 to $25 million a year for the past 4 years. I think that people feel that they deserve far worse than they got, because they really hurt a lot of people. But I think, you know, every little bit helps. Hey, they don't like signing those checks, I can be sure.
Gretchen Morgenson, thanks so much for joining us from New York.
Anytime, Bill.
Gretchen Morgenson, the economic writer for the New York Times.
Just ahead, our D.C. roundtable looks at the domestic battlefield, with fights in Washington over tax cuts and cutting comments.
And later, 20th century Iraqi poetry. It may surprise you, now published in the United States.
Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Iraq's former Deputy Prime Minister Tariq Aziz has told U.S. interrogators that Saddam Hussein has survived two airstrikes that were launched to kill him. For more on this story, go to our website, WBUR.org, and click on news. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Acela Express, offering 10 departures every weekday to New York and Washington, D.C. Acela Express, keep moving. More information at Amtrak.com.
Jaymiles.com. And Jay Miles, a neighborhood boutique dedicated to serving a community of women interested in a personalized approach to shopping on Huron Ave in Cambridge. Jay Miles, distinctive dressing for discerning women. It's already 76 degrees, sunny skies this afternoon, highs around 80. Tonight, clear in the 40s. Tomorrow, another lovely warm day with lots of sunshine and highs in the upper 70s. Could see some clouds on Wednesday, maybe some rain for Thursday and Friday, but right now, 76 and sunny in Boston.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
This week, President Bush is expected to declare that the war in Iraq is over, and Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld is expected to say the same thing about the conflict in Afghanistan. But administration officials are cautioning the war on terror is not over, and neither is the battle over the tax cut. Meanwhile, several new combatants have entered the arena. Former Speaker of the House Newt Gingrich is back on the radar. Pennsylvania Senator Rick Santorum is there as well, along with Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist. Joining us to preview the week ahead in Washington politics are members of our D.C. roundtable. Bill Douglas is a correspondent for Newsday. Hi, Bill.
How are you?
Good. And Andrea Stone, correspondent for USA Today. Hello, Andrea.
Hi.
Well, Bill, to you first. The president's going to Dearborn, Michigan today to speak with Iraqi exiles. On Thursday, he's going to spend the night on a returning aircraft carrier. But to Michigan first, this is his ninth visit to that state. Why?
Well, it's a state that's always in play in presidential elections. It's got a lot of electoral votes. It's also home to a large Arab population. This is the president's way of one, extending an olive branch to the Arab-American community, basically declaring that the hard part of the war is basically finished. The rebuilding phase will begin. It's something that a lot of Iraqi exiles have longed to hear. So that's another purpose for being in Dearborn.
But, Andrea, Michigan has the highest jobless rate in 9 years. They're at 6.6% unemployment. Doesn't the president run the risk of reminding people of that?
Well, now that the war seems to be over, we're going to hear a lot about tax cuts. And as Congress is returning today, that's the number one agenda item, is how, you know, will there be a tax cut and how big will it be? And that is going to be what the president's going to try to hammer on.
Well, Bill, Congress returns from recess this week, and with only 4 weeks to go before Memorial Day recess, it's thought that tax cuts will be their main topic as well. Bill, do you agree with that?
Yes. The tax cuts are an issue that the Democrats feel they can make some gains on politically because they view the White House and President Bush as rather weak on the economy. The Republicans also want to put through the tax cut, though they're somewhat divided themselves. You've got some members who don't want to support a tax cut as large as the president wants. That said, the president's going to continue to push the large tax cut, which is another reason why he's on the road today.
And, of course, everyone's going to be watching to see whether Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist pulls in the votes that the president wants for the tax cut. Right now he's in the doghouse because he failed on the last go-around. But let's talk about some other interesting people popping up in Washington news. Former House Speaker Newt Gingrich lambasting Colin Powell in the State Department for being too polite pre and during the Iraq War.
Right. It was we saw the return of Newt Gingrich this week, and it was kind of a raucous scene there. He really took after the State Department. Well, he didn't name any names, i.e., you know, Colin Powell, but that obviously was who he was talking about. And Richard Armitage told our reporter Barbara Slavin this week that he obviously was off his meds and out of therapy,
yeah.
Which was the quote of the week, I think.
Dick Armitage, by the way, number two at State.
Right, right.
Bill, there is some speculation that Newt Gingrich was sent out by Donald Rumsfeld, who routinely forwards emails that Newt Gingrich sends him on military strategy to other members of the Defense Department, according to Maureen Dowd in the Times. What about that thinking?
I mean, that was sort of the speculation here in Washington. I mean, to send out Newt Gingrich to be your attack dog is sort of a double-edged sword. Gingrich was Speaker of the House. He left office in a bit of a controversy. There's a good question about how much clout he has on the Hill today. I suspect very little. So to have him as your messenger could backfire on you. And Gingrich also has a bit of a reputation of being about Gingrich.
Well, we also have Pennsylvania Senator Rick Santorum, the third-ranking Republican in the Senate. He made remarks comparing gay relationships to incest. So what do you think, Andrea? Will he have to resign his leadership post?
No, I don't think this is another Trent Lott call that he had to resign after making some comments about race. I think race is sort of the rail you don't touch, but I think attitudes about gays and homosexuality still left him some wiggle room. And after a few days of silence, the White House did come out and vouch for Santorum. And I think now that the Senate is back in session this week, they're going to move on to other things.
Mm. Also, I think Senator Santorum is the beneficiary of a fairly busy news cycle.
Right.
A lot happened in basically a lull, a period of very little news. The Santorum comments sort of happened while a war is winding down. The economy is still in a bit of a state. So he's lucky in that regard that there's other news.
One last spat. Andrea, Senator Richard Lugar is going to hold a hearing tomorrow on reconstructing Iraq. And we understand he's not happy with the administration.
No, he is the head of the Foreign Relations Committee, and he has been very critical of the Bush administration, especially not so much for the war plan, but for the post-war plan. He and other leading Republicans, such as Jim Colby and Henry Hyde in the House, have been very critical of the administration for not having a plan for the day after we declare victory.
Mm. Is it my imagination, or are there more spats than usual in Washington?
There's been a lot of fighting lately. I don't know. What do you think, Bill?
It's been an interesting period. I mean, there are. And I think part of it's territorial. I think part of it's electoral. Next year's a campaign year. You've got people in the administration vying for the president's attention. That would be the Secretary of Defense and the Secretary of State. And a lot of people are just very anxious right now.
Yeah, a lot of sharp elbows. Andrew, do you think that these sharp elbows will translate into more action or less?
Well, I think because the tax debate is about to begin, we're going to see a lot of elbowing. But in terms of on the foreign policy, I don't see any peace. We may be having a more peace in Iraq, but I don't see any truce between state and the Pentagon. Mm.
No, this will continue for quite some time because they're married. Despite the fact that the Bush administration wants most of the funding directed for reconstruction at the towards the Pentagon, the state still plays a very important role, and they're still the flagship for diplomacy. So these two are going to have to learn to either coexist or just go about their business.
Well, that's really a question of who's going to run foreign policy, the State Department or the Pentagon.
Well, thank you so much, both of you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Bill Douglas is a correspondent for Newsday. Andrea Stone, correspondent for USA Today, members of our D.C. roundtable.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, journalist and author Lori Garrett thinks SARS is here to stay, and she says the world's health systems are not healthy enough to cope with it.
And we hear music from the debut of Juanito Pascual, a flamenco guitarist from Madrid, making waves in the U.S. That's tomorrow.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Boston Private Bank and Trust Company, providing banking and investment services to successful people, their families, and their businesses on the web at bostonprivatebank.com. Also, Sudbury Granite and Marble, direct importer and fabricator of granite and marble services for homes in Boston and the Cape and Islands in Sudbury, Mendon, and West Hartford, Connecticut. See what's new at the Public Radio Store this week, featuring tapes and CDs from Pimsleur Direct, offering language learning programs for more than 35 languages and donating 30% of every sale to WBUR. That's the Public Radio Store at WBUR.org. Coming up on Fresh Air, Terry Gross talks with historian Margaret McMillan about the 1919 Paris Peace Conference and the drawing of new boundaries in the Middle East. That's Fresh Air at 1 o'clock here on WBUR.
In County Clare, Ireland, you'll find one of the greatest natural wonders of Europe, the mighty cliffs of Moher. Running for miles along Ireland's west coast and rising nearly 700 feet straight up from the spray of the Atlantic. The cliffs are just one of the highlights on our next Citizens of the World tour to Ireland this summer. Proceeds help pay for the news. Learn more about the trip at a free reception on Thursday, May 8th. To reserve your space, call 800-909-9287.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, proudly supporting public radio and serving the community, on the web at MathWorks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, terrorism trials are on the docket at home and abroad. We review the most critical cases and find that, like the groups they're targeting, the trials are interconnected.
There's no such thing as a domestic terrorism case anymore. The connections literally are international, and therefore if you want to even just investigate a case so that you can bring it to trial, you really need to have an international effort.
And after 30 years of oppression, their verse can now be read. We speak with the editor of a new anthology of Iraqi poetry.
These stories coming up Here and Now.
I'm Marianne Nichols. The worst of the SARS outbreak is apparently over in Singapore, Hong Kong, and Canada. This, according to the World Health Organization, which also says that Vietnam has contained the pneumonia-like illness. But officials say SARS is spreading in China, despite aggressive efforts by the Chinese government to halt the spread of severe acute respiratory syndrome. There were 8 new SARS-related fatalities in China today, 5 in Hong Kong and 1 in Singapore. Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld met with his Australian counterpart today in Qatar. Rumsfeld says the presence of the U.S. military in the region is likely to be reduced because Iraq no longer poses a threat to the United States and its interests.
Iraq was a threat in the region, and because that threat will be gone, we also have the ability to adjust some of our arrangements. So we have good friends and allies here in the region. We've had long, multiple-decade relationships, and we intend to maintain those relationships.
The defense secretary also praised the efforts of U.S. allies in the region who have helped during the war in Iraq. Iraqi volunteers have located secret files that offer details of where and when political prisoners were executed. Associated Press correspondent Lourdes Navarro reports.
Hundreds come crowding into this once lavish house on the banks of the Tigris River. Peering at lists of names on the walls, they are searching for loved ones taken by Saddam Hussein's regime.
My uncle had been arrested since 1982.
I miss three brothers.
I'm looking for my father.
A group of former Iraqi political prisoners formed the Committee of Free Prisoners after finding rooms filled with secret intelligence documents all around Baghdad. What the documents detail is staggering: how and where thousands of political dissidents were executed and buried. Already, due to the diligent work of the volunteers here, many have been able to find and collect the remains of those executed. Others still come here day after day, hoping that they can unearth the past and rebury those they lost. Lourdes Navarro, Baghdad.
Yasser Arafat's Fatah movement says it will support incoming Prime Minister Mahmoud Abbas's proposed cabinet, making it more likely that a confirmation vote will be taken tomorrow in the Palestinian parliament. President Bush says he'll release the U.S. peace plan for establishing a Palestinian state within 3 years when Abbas is accepted as prime minister. On Wall Street today, the Dow's up 140 points at 84.47, NASDAQ up 23 points at 14.58. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Chobi Hoy Associates, previous winner of the TAB's Reader's Choice Award for 4 consecutive years, offering real estate consultation for sales or rentals, 617-739-0067. And Mississippi's baked sweet potato pie, flourless chocolate cake, peach cobbler, and a dozen other desserts. In the forecast, sunny skies this afternoon with highs around 80. Tonight, mostly clear, lows in the mid-40s. Tomorrow, another sunny day with temperatures in the upper 70s. Look for clouds on Wednesday and possibly rain Thursday and Friday. Right now, 76 and sunny in Boston. In sports, the Red Sox will host the Central Division-leading Kansas City Royals at Fenway Park tomorrow night. That's game one of a 6-game homestand. And the Celtics will be in Indianapolis tomorrow night to try and wrap up the playoff series against the Pacers. Right now, the Celtics lead that series 3-1. This is WBUR.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Across the country, a series of terrorism trials are moving forward, despite being mostly off the front pages of the nation's papers. To remind us which trials are ongoing and whether they're really taking a bite out of terrorism, we're joined from Washington by Siobhan Roth, reporter for the Legal Times. And Siobhan, it's been about a year and a half since September 11th and the beginning of the war on terror. So tell us, first of all, with numbers, how many terrorism trials are going on right now?
Well, there are several going on right now. In Detroit, for example, four men are on trial for conspiring to provide material support to terrorists. In New York, four men have pleaded guilty to participating in al-Qaeda training camps, and two others are awaiting trial. And in Oregon, there is a group of people set to go to trial in October for conspiring to provide material support to terrorists. The idea seems to be to follow the money and to try those who are funneling money or services to al-Qaeda. Meanwhile, there are two men being held as enemy combatants. They are U.S. citizens. One is Yasser Hamdi. The other is Jose Padilla. And the government has appealed a decision in the Padilla case. A federal judge ruled that Padilla could meet with his attorney and challenge his detention. The government has asked the Second Circuit to reverse that decision.
Mm. Meanwhile, Zakarias Moussaoui is perhaps the one trial that people are most familiar with, accused of actually participating in the 9/11 plot. His case raises an interesting question. He's asking to be able to question an alleged captured member of al-Qaeda who reportedly said he wasn't involved in 9/11. If he does win this right to question this al-Qaeda member, what will that mean for other terrorism trials?
Well, it would be a stunning blow to the government. The government has written in its brief to the appeals court that the courts are trying to micromanage warfare if criminal defendants, are allowed to depose enemy combatants that are in U.S. custody overseas.
How about the legal community? How are these trials viewed?
Civil libertarians have a number of issues with a lot of these trials. They definitely think that Moussaoui should be able to depose a key witness in his case. In the case of immigration cases, which the government has held in secret, civil libertarians have cried foul and said that you cannot have secret hearings, and that goes against the basic tenets of democracy. In terms of the material support cases in Oregon, New York, and Detroit, those have not caused as much of a furor. The charges are simpler, but many civil libertarians do find it troubling that people are being put on trial for activities which, prior to September 11th, would not have perhaps risen to a criminal level. Mm.
And overall, the number of trials, it seems like a handful to us. As someone who tracks trials, does it seem like a lot to you?
No, considering the breadth of the dragnet, the size of the dragnet that the government pulled in following September 11th, these are fairly few trials. And there is, remember, only one trial connected to the actual September 11th terrorist attacks, and that's Zakarias Moussaoui.
Mm. Siobhan, thank you.
Thank you.
Siobhan Roth is with The Legal Times. She spoke to us from Washington, D.C.
From trials in the U.S., we now shift focus to trials overseas, where one thing that quickly becomes clear is the sheer scope of terrorism. Attacks carried out, attacks allegedly planned by cells from Indonesia to Germany to Great Britain to Spain, and the list could continue. To catch up on the cases out there as much as we can in a few minutes, we're joined by Matthew Levitt, who's senior fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, who's also a former FBI terrorism analyst. Welcome, Mr. Levitt.
Thanks, Bill.
Mr. Levitt, terror goes on, as we know, sometimes seemingly almost, I guess, under the radar, at least from our perspective in this country. Just yesterday, there was a terror bombing in Indonesia, injuring at least six near a Kentucky Fried Chicken counter. Now, how many cases involving terror are now being carried through courts around the world outside the U.S.? Just an estimate.
Many. I wouldn't give an estimate because there are many that are that we actually know about, that are many that are in the process. But we're talking about dozens at a minimum.
Yeah.
Trials that are in process or that investigations that are about to lead to trials in Southeast Asia, throughout Europe, even in South America and Asia. Terror has not necessarily increased. It's just that we are addressing it now in a much more global type of effort.
Just to boil it down, what's your sense of the most important cases out there?
I think the most important cell that has been broken up and therefore the most important cases that we'll see may be the cell in Madrid. The Madrid cell not only was financing the gentlemen in Hamburg who were behind the 9/11 plot, one of their members also conducted what is believed to have been pre-operational surveillance in the United States a couple of years in advance. and has financial ties going to Palestinian groups, back to Saudi Arabia. It's a real matrix of links that appear to have hubbed in Madrid.
I see.
There also are a series of cases in Germany. There was just a recent cell that was broken up and will be coming to trial shortly, I'm sure, in Berlin. There are, of course, the ricin incidents in Great Britain.
Ricin, the poison that was allegedly found in an apartment in Britain, yes?
In an apartment and other material in a mosque that was frequented by several other known extremists, including Moussaoui and José Padilla, the dirty bomber.
Both of whom are in the United States, showing the sort of, as you call it, a matrix of these cells around the world.
Well, that's what it comes down to. You know, there's no such thing as a domestic terrorism case anymore when it comes to international terrorist groups. The connections literally are international, and therefore, if you want to even just investigate a case so that you can bring it to trial, you really need to have an international effort. You know, for all of the discussion, for example, about the tension in the transatlantic relationship that occurred in the context of the war with Iraq, and even as we were engaging in the effort to liberate Iraq and all that tension was going on, cooperation on the law enforcement and intelligence side pertaining to the war on terrorism was continuing. And U.S. officials were in Europe throughout that period and vice versa to continue to put together these cases.
Mr. Levitt, just in the little time we have left, what is the particular difficulty of trying terrorism cases?
Well, there are several. The most critical, I'd say, is protecting sources and methods. We're talking about cases that start off usually as an intelligence investigation. And then at some point you make a decision that you've collected all the intelligence you need or can collect, and so that you're best positioned to thwart subsequent attacks, which of course is the priority. But then at a certain point you do want to prosecute these individuals for their criminal activities. And converting an intelligence investigation into a law enforcement case is very difficult. We saw in the trial of Munir Mutasidik in Germany that case almost fell through. In the end he was convicted for his role in the 9/11 plot, but it almost fell through because of difficulties in dealing with sources and methods, intelligence sources and methods, and we see that now also here with Zakarias Moussaoui.
Mm-hmm. Matthew Levitt, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Matthew Levitt is a senior fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy and a former FBI terrorism analyst.
Still to come, an Iraqi exile tortured during Saddam Hussein's rule is now the editor of a new anthology of Iraqi poetry published in the U.S.
You're listening to Here and Now.
Today begins the 39th day of solitary confinement for Maher, known as Mike Hawash, a 38-year-old American citizen detained for undisclosed reasons by his government. Hawash is being held without charge in a high-security prison south of Portland, Oregon. He's being held as a material witness to a terrorist plot. His detention, under a secret warrant heard in a secret court, is for an indefinite period. We turn to Stephen McGady. He's a friend of the Hawash family and former vice president at Intel, the computer company where Mike Hawash works as a software engineer. Hello, Stephen.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Well, I know the government isn't saying outright, but what is the speculation about why Mike Hawash has been detained?
Well, there's lots of speculation, most of which we try to avoid. Some people think it might have been because of some charity donations he made. Others think it might be because of some travel to his mother's home in Palestine. But we're really mostly concerned about the fact of his detention rather than speculating on what he might know or what he might have done.
Has he been charged with anything? Have his lawyers told you or his family anything he's been charged with?
No, his lawyers are under a gag order, like almost everyone else involved in this case. They can't say anything. But we know he hasn't been charged with a crime. He's being held, as you said, as a material witness.
One of several Americans across the country being held without charges. He has a wife and three children. Have they seen him?
Yes, they have been able to visit him since a little bit after he was arrested, although they have not seen him in the last week or so. We're hoping that they get to see him in freedom after tomorrow's detention hearing.
Yeah. As we understand it, the law does permit detention of a material witness if he might be a flight risk. You know Mike Hawash. Is he likely to be a flight risk?
It's really hard for any of us who know him to believe that a man with a job three kids, a wife, and a house in the suburb, a man who's a 15-year U.S. citizen, a 20-year U.S. resident, would be considered a flight risk by anybody.
We understand that some in the community worry that he's being held because he attended the same mosque as two people accused of participating in terrorism. With that in mind, how have you seen this impact people?
Well, there's a great deal of fear in the Arab American and Muslim communities here in Portland, Oregon. Everyone is afraid that this could happen to them next. Not only, in fact, the Arab Americans and Muslims, but I think a lot of regular people are wondering if a guy like Mike, you know, just minding his own business, working as a software engineer here, can be arrested, his wife and children awoken in the morning by 20 FBI agents with assault rifles. I think people wonder whether it could happen to them next.
I understand there's going to be a supportive rally tomorrow. Any word on when Mike Hawash might be released?
Well, there is this closed detention hearing before which we'll be rallying tomorrow, and we hope he'll be released tomorrow or soon thereafter.
Is that wishful thinking on your part, or do you have some sense that that might happen?
Well, really, there's three or four things that could happen tomorrow. One is that he could be released. The judge could find that he has given his grand jury testimony and he can go free. He may be charged with a crime, in which case that charge, of course, needs to become public rather than secret. Or he may be detained in secret for a longer period of time. And that third possibility is what we've really been concerned about. We feel that this kind of secret material witness detention is a violation of due process rights.
Whether or not it happens to be a friend of yours.
That's right.
Stephen, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Stephen McGady spoke to us from Portland, Oregon. We contacted the Justice Department for this story, but our calls were not returned.
Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by UR listeners and by Mirtha Kalina, LLP, a law firm with offices in Boston, Woburn, Hartford, and New Haven, serving the legal needs of businesses and individuals throughout New England and on the web at mirthalaw.com. And the Sunset Grill and Tap and the new Sunset Cantina, 916 Comm Ave in Boston, featuring steam beer burgers, fiesta nachos, and all-you-can-eat barbecue Texas ribs on Mondays and Tuesdays. Now is your chance to make a pledge for the news that enters your name in a drawing to win a new Apple iBook laptop computer, courtesy of Tech Superpowers. Enter the drawing with your $100 pledge for the news online at WBUR.org. Coming up on Fresh Air at 1 o'clock, Terry Gross talks with historian Margaret McMillan. It's 76 degrees right now and sunny in Boston, 60 in Chatham, and 67 on Martha's Vineyard. It's 1248.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Iran Now.
Even through the decades, Saddam Hussein intimidated and silenced so many Iraqis. Iraq's poets continued to write, kept their faith in the transformative and healing power of words. Beauty, passion, now made accessible to English readers as never before in a new book, Iraqi Poetry Today, which collects the work of 40 contemporary Iraqi poets, most of whom, not surprisingly perhaps, wrote their poems in exile. Now, to guide us through the new anthology, we're joined by the editor, Professor Sadi Samawi, from his office at Grinnell University in Iowa. Welcome, Professor.
Hi, thank you.
Also on the line, from her home just outside of Detroit, is Dunya Mikhail, one of the new book's contributing poets. Thanks for joining us, Ms. Mikhail.
Welcome.
Professor Samawi, let's start with you, and we want to get to the poetry as soon as we can. So much of it so powerful and lyrical, but so much of it, too, informed by something you know a bit about, exile and tragedy. Professor, please share with our audience just briefly as we get started your story. What happened to you when you were just a teenager?
Well, I was jailed in Iraq because I was participating in the opposition movement, and we used to publish literature against the government of the Ba'ath Party in 1963. I was jailed for 6 years.
And tortured?
Yeah. Nobody can be jailed without torture in Iraq.
Yeah, let's move on from those dark times to the present time and this marvelous book. Professor, you started working on this book 2 years ago, and, of course, that was well before the real hardcore war drums were being heard around the world. Now at this very moment, the anthology seems so necessary, doesn't it?
It is. And I'm happy it is out this time because I was motivated from the beginning to publish this poetry in English because the media in this country and in the West in general equated Iraq and the Iraqi people with Saddam Hussein, which I thought that was very demonizing, very dehumanizing. So I thought only poetry and literature can save Iraqi humanity from this dehumanization.
Professor, what do you want these poems to show, to reflect to English readers about Iraq?
I think I wanted to show that Iraqi culture is very rich, that the poems should highlight the importance and the interesting complexity of Iraqi humanity in terms of ethnicity and religious background. And also I was much interested in highlighting the complexity of culture. This poetry speaks of the images from Mesopotamia to the present time. Mesopotamian images, Islamic images, Christian images, Jewish images. Iraq is a very complex society. Most people don't know anything about that. Mm. In fact, Iraqis believe that there are not only two major rivers in Iraq. That's the ancient rivers of Tigris and Euphrates. There's a third river. That's poetry.
Well, this might be a good moment then to bring in an Iraqi poet, and a wonderful one. Dunya Mikhail, we'd like to hear one or two of your poems. Why don't you choose one and read it to us? And we were talking earlier, we'd like to hear it certainly first in Arabic, such a beautiful language. And then you can translate for us.
Okay. This is a short one. Al-Jawhara. لم يعد مطلاً على النهر. إنه ليس في المدينة. ليس على الخريطة. الجسر الذي كان. الجسر الذي كنا نعبره كل يوم. الجسر رمته الحرب في النهر مثل ما فعلت تلك السيدة بجوهرتها الزرقاء من فوق سفينة تايتانيك.
And what do those gorgeous sounds mean in English?
It sounds like this. Title is the jewel. It no longer overlooks the river, no longer is in the city, no longer on the map, the bridge that was. The bridge that we used to cross every day. The bridge. The war tossed it into the river. Just as that lady aboard the Titanic tossed her blue diamond.
What is this poem about?
Well, let me tell you this in order to give you the background. I was in Iraq in the 91 Gulf War. I did not leave Iraq until 95. So I witnessed two wars. I opened my eyes to the Iraq-Iran war, and then there was the Gulf War. And so I was there, and where I used to live is very close to one of the bridges on the Tigris River. And when, you know, it was the scene of the bridge that was tossed in the river, for me was so moving because I used to cross that almost every day. And this image stayed in my head. And I don't know why, when I watched here in America the film of Titanic, I don't know why it reminded me of Iraq. And I don't know why remember that scene when the lady, she threw the her jewel, the blue one? Do you remember?
Of course, yes.
So it reminded me of the things that were dropped just like that. And one of them is that bridge.
Now, Professor, when you heard Dunya read that poem in Arabic, and then you hear the English translation. Are we losing something in the translation? Talk to us about the complexities and challenges of translation.
The complexity of the translation is very frustrating, primarily because you have to lose some, but you have to gain some at the same time. The most important thing that you lose is the sound of the language. But when you read it in English, it acquires a different life, really.
Mm. Dunya's poem, a poem about loss, about exile, ultimately, I suppose. Tell us some of the other themes that run through this book, Iraqi Poetry Today.
Besides the traditional themes like death and love and hate and exile and all that, there are other themes that emerged after the coming of fascism in Iraq in 1963. The theme of the West as an enemy, torture, the theme of prison, the theme of exile, war, the theme of oil, sanctions, homeland, and nostalgia.
Hmm. Can you read us a poem?
Yeah, I will read a very short poem. It's three lines. It's called Sanctions by a poet who lives in London. His name is Sadiq al-Sahir. On the street today, I sold a bag heavy with guards out of sheer hunger. Now, the context of this poem is that Iraqis usually don't sell their books. They love their books. They never sell it. But the sanctions forced many Iraqis, writers and intellectuals, to sell their books. So when he said a bag heavy with guards, he means a bag heavy with books.
I wonder if it surprises some of our listeners how very modern these poems are, at least in English translation. Modernism, the modernism of Paris in the 20s and T.S. Eliot and Ezra Pound, reached Iraq.
Yes, sure. Modernism in Iraq was influenced by the West. Even poets like Whitman, Emily Dickinson, British poets like Edith Sitwell, all these people were translated, and Iraqi poets learned from them ideas, techniques, many of their stylistics.
Professor, there are some five poets in this book of 40 or more poets who actually still live in Iraq. Can you find us a poem by someone still living in Iraq and tell us a bit about that poet?
Sure. This poet, his name is Abdurrahim Saleh al-Rahim. He lives in the south in the Diwaniyah, which is about 3 kilometers or 150 miles south of Baghdad. He still lives there, and this poem is one of his many poems that speak of fear, which we call sometimes the cosmic Iraqi fear. Iraq has been saturated with fear to the point that anything is frightening sometimes. Family, friends, nature, anything. So this is called Poisonous Illusions. The stars above that have always fascinated us, carrying us off into the labyrinth of the imagination, are probably spying on us. Have they deceived us all these years? Perhaps it is the stars in their awesome beauty that are snatching away our souls. Hmm.
There's much more to talk about, and there are many more poems in Iraqi poetry today, but that's all the time we have for this. But we want to thank Professor Sadi Samawi for joining us. Thank you, Professor.
Thank you very much.
And a wonderful poet, Dunya Mikhail. Thank you, Dunya.
Thank you for having us.
Professor Sadi Samawi is the editor, and Dunya Mikhail is one of the many contributing poets for the new anthology, Iraqi Poetry Today. For more information, visit our website, here-now.org.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Stay tuned to your public radio station for the latest news.
And join us again, Here and Now. For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software. Information on the web at mathworks.com.
This is WBUR. This is WBUR.